Sweetheart, dear precious woman. One was the Samaritan woman, remember? The woman with the worst reputation in the drunken town, in the despised country. And it says Jesus had to go through Samaria. No, he didn't. Not geographically, he didn't. But he had an appointment on God's appointment book for him to talk to this woman, and he addressed her that way. The adulteress that is recorded as having been in the act of being executed, Jesus addressed her with that word. And here, Mary Magdalene, who had had seven demons cast out of her. If you've ever talked with anyone or been somebody, known somebody close that has been under severe addictions, where they have no self-determination, they have no control over their mind anymore, no control over their body. Everything revolves around that addiction. You know how precious it is when Jesus gives you yourself back. I can imagine why she loved him the way that she did. Remember the unclean women that broke through the, violated the law, broke through a crowd of people? Jesus addressed her with a diminutive form of this term. And Lazarus's sister, Mary, who, if you connect the dots with the gospel accounts, had been a prostitute before, who was certainly not, all of these women, none of them probably had ever had a holy man address them in this way. So my radar just picked up on this, and I had heard this taught many, many times with just the English word woman, sort of in a curt, sharp way, which sounds dismissive and demeaning, which would have been accurate to most anybody in that culture except Jesus. It always bothered me, especially when it seemed like he talked to his mom that way. So when all else fails, look up the words. And I was just so thrilled when I found that word. It became one of my favorite words. So here's this encounter. She gets to be the very first one. Why? We're really not given that information. I think one of the primary reasons maybe is because she was just there. Don't know. There seems to have been some sort of a special relationship between these two. Jesus seems to indicate at the end of this passage that it was going to change. But as he told the disciples in John 15, yeah, I am going away. That's the bad news. The good news is it's going to be better. You're going to have me inside of you, living within you, which is way closer. And for that reason, I have to go away and not bodily be here anymore. So the relationship was going to change, but it was going to be better. I always picture Jesus smiling when he said, "Why are you crying and who are you looking for?" And he's just standing there, biggest life. Have you ever had an experience in your life where you're just, all you can see in front of your eyeballs is loss or grief, and sometime later, Jesus opens your eyes and you realize that he was with you way back there. He was there, he was there, he was there, he was there, and you realize he never left you. You just didn't see it. And I love this interchange for that reason. So the upshot of that encounter, Mark tells us here, back to Mark verse 10. She went and she told those who had been with him, who were mourning and weeping. I don't know why, I just find those words so sad. But you know what? I've been there. I have a little rabbit trail marked out in my notes that says, talk about inappropriate emotional responses which come from not believing Jesus. Anybody relate to that? Have you found yourself jumping to conclusions and being hot under the collar and then had to apologize later because you realize you just didn't have all the facts in yet? Have you felt abandoned and, God, you're not paying attention? And then realize he was not only paying attention, he had a way more brilliant plan than you did, and it was unfolding. I could tell you so many stories because I'm famous for this. I'm famous for, well, in the past, I'm a lot better at it. I've been embarrassed too many times. At lecturing God on his poor choice of timing. And God, perhaps you didn't read the 15-page outline that I gave you with the handy little, you know, schedule on the back of how, here's the 10 best ways you can answer this prayer, and here's the way that it should go. And he seemed to just, you know, why the hell? I shouldn't have wadded up my notes. What was I thinking? Good visual aid, though, wasn't it? She went to tell the guys and the other women that were mourning and weeping. We've talked about this a number of times, and I've just thought, he told them so many times. He promised them. He never lied to them. They had watched, by the way, I've heard people say, well, you have to give them a break, Bob. They'd never seen a dead person rise from the dead before. Au contraire. They saw it with their own eyes a couple of times. And Jesus did it. Oh, yeah, but that's different. So he tells them all these times that he's going to do it. And they reacted completely the wrong way. They could have had a 3-day tailgate party. Just off to the side from the tomb there, there's that nice little grove of trees. They could have set up the barbecue there. They could have just been partying down. And then, you know, the last 10 seconds, 10, 9, 8, you know, waiting for, you know, whatever was going to happen. How's he going to do it? I don't know how he's going to do it. We know that they didn't have to have the stone rolled away for him to get out. Because later when he met with them, it says he Jesus appeared in the room, the doors and windows being locked. Sorry, but I've seen way too many Star Trek episodes to not have that materialize in my mind as the, you know, Scotty beaming him down and, you know, those little, however he did it, he didn't need the stone out of the way. That was for them to get in. That was for them to witness that it happened. We talked about that last week as well, that the penalty for violating a Roman seal, which Pilate had placed on that tomb, was instantaneous. Death, no questions asked. So she went to tell them, but it says they did not believe it. My NIV says, but essentially they didn't believe her. I pointed out last week that women were not considered to be reliable enough witnesses in Jewish society at that time to be allowed to be a witness in a court of law. Well, we've got 50 women who actually saw this happen and said, sorry, they're women. They're not reliable witnesses. Does that make the hair on the back of your neck stand up? Some of you alpha females. I know it does. Which is why I find it so touching. I find it so touching how many times Jesus defended women to religious leaders, to his own disciples. You got to love that about him. When people don't believe you, when people think you're a worthless loser, it's happened to me. I was dragged before a group of pastors one time in my life. I simply told them the truth over rumors that they had been hearing, and they didn't believe me. It's a horrible feeling. I remember crying out to the Lord that night and saying, Lord, I don't understand this. They're your servants. You know what the truth is. He said the coolest thing to me. He said the reason that they did what they did and the reason I let them do what they did are not the same reason. They didn't believe it because they're jerks, you know, because they're judgmental. I let it happen, and I let them not believe it just to prove something to you. I know what the truth is. I will vindicate you. And he did. And with Mary Magdalene, he did as well. How do you suppose she felt? Yeah, I told you the truth. Yeah, Jesus just said. You guys were hard-hearted because you didn't believe me. Flip over to Luke 24, and we'll look at this second account. The road to Emmaus, I love this one. Does it tell us their names? It tells one of them's name, Cleopas, right? Maybe just one of them didn't want his name to be known. Maybe he just felt really stupid. There's a reason why I'm doing this morning. Follow this thread. You'll see a definite thread in these passages. You'll see that God can be absolutely faithful to all of his promises, and his own people can be bummed out and depressed and afraid simply because we don't believe him. Two things I want you to notice. One is that he keeps his promises anyway. Thank goodness. And that he understands. I personally think that when he's proven something to me that I doubted for a long time, I realized that he had been trying to help me. He'd repeated the promises over and over and over, and I either blew it off by saying, yeah, right, I've heard that before, or else I thought, well, those fabulous promises, they don't apply to me. They apply to really good people like Mike, you know, but they don't apply to me, you know. I love the scripture you read, Mark. It just fits so beautifully. That God will keep in perfect peace the person whose mind is steadfast because they trust in him. I'm always fighting a battle with my mind. And if I'm not fighting a battle with my mind, I'm fighting a battle with my emotions, which is why, and I always love what George MacDonald said. He said, emotions are not scientific instruments. They're real, but they don't measure reality very accurately often. That's why I love the scriptures and scripture in Philippians 4 that talks about when I refuse to be anxious and I do the four P's. Remember that? It says the peace of God which surpasses human understanding will guard your what? Your mind and your heart. And I need both of those. Notice also in these two passages the word hard-hearted, and actually in all of these accounts. Sclerocardia is the Greek word. It's really easy to translate. Can I tell you something about hard hearts? They don't happen overnight. Hard-heartedness is a habit. And good habits and bad habits are formed the same way, and that's by repetition. So, Luke 24. Now, that same day, two of them, that's two disciples, were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. I just love this. I would love to see a movie of this. Because Jesus just looks just a tad bit sneaky. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. I remember looking at all the verbs in that statement and realizing that in Greek it covers a protracted distance and a goodly amount of time. So he's walking along with them for a while. And then verse 16 says, but they were kept from recognizing him. It literally, if you were to break this down in the Greek text, it's their eyes were restrained from recognizing him. And then later on in the story, their eyes were opened. Both deliberate actions. That's why Mark says Jesus in another form met with two of them walking out in the country. If we were spending all our time in John's account, I'd talk to you about our new bodies and what they're like, because Paul told us they're going to be just like Jesus's body that he got after the resurrection. There's some interesting information about what that might be like. I don't know all of the details. We don't have all the details. I'm just glad I get out of this one. And I'm not going to have an organ recital and tell you all of my organs that are not working properly. So they were kept from recognizing him, and he asked them, again, I'm sorry, I have to see him smiling. He knows what they're talking about. And yet he says, what are you discussing together as you walk along? Hey, what are you guys talking about? Love this. They stood still. They stopped, their faces downcast. They were sad and depressed. And one of them, named Cleopas, asked him, what turnip truck did you just fall off of? Are you the only visitor? And don't you wish he could take those words back about an hour later? Sorry, Jesus, you know that whole thing I said, you know, but yeah, what an idiot you were. This is why I picture Jesus smiling. Folks, we're all idiots when we lecture God. When we presume to tell him there's a better way of doing things, or we think he's not paying attention. God, if you just paid a little bit closer attention, this never would have happened. And we're idiots. That's why I think he's smiling. Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem and do not know the things that have happened there in these days? And I always write a smiley face next to this next one. And he says, what things? Literally, it's what sort of things? About Jesus of Nazareth, they replied, getting tense. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. You get that they read this on a poster somewhere about, you know, appearing tonight. And, you know, here's the little PR blurb. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. Listen to these are the saddest words ever spoken, I believe, by a disciple of Jesus. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. He did redeem Israel. Why was their hope dead? It's all about unfulfilled expectations. It's my theory. You don't have to accept this, but I beg you to ponder it. It may shine the light on the roller coaster ride and emotionally in your life at times as it has mine. I believe that all disappointment with God is premature. And that all, because we haven't seen the whole story yet, I believe that all disappointment with God at its roots has to do with the fact that we expected something different. It's kind of fun. The longer you walk with him and the more he cures this, you know, pries your stiff little white fingers off of the steering wheel and just, you know, lets you relax in his arms and teaches you how faithful he is. After a while, when things don't work out the way you thought, you start getting excited because you think, oh, wow, this is going to be good because nobody would have ever thought about this. And then you wait expectantly. Unfulfilled expectations. Man, been there and I've done that. Remember when we studied Job? The two primary lessons we learned from the book of Job in a nutshell, in my estimation, are that for a godly person, all suffering is temporary. And for a godly person, all disappointment with God is premature. And yet we're famous for having just the opposite view. I tell you, when you're suffering, it feels like this is going to be the whole rest of your life. And even if it was the rest of your earthly life, that's a blip on the radar screen for the billions and billions of timeless years, whatever they're going to be called, that you're going to be with him. In which case, you'll be more alive than you are now. So what's to lose? So their unfulfilled expectations caused them to say, we'd hoped, we had hoped he was the one. Who is going to redeem Israel? Can I just offer one thing to you? I found this to be true, and you can consider this in your own situation. One of the reasons why God appears to not be answering the prayer that's urgent at the top of my list is that on his list, it's not the top of the list. He's doing something else that's more important that requires waiting. Especially when you're praying for somebody you love. And we think he's not listening, and he's just taking the long view. It's an already written story. He knows how it's going to turn out. He knows, okay, yeah, all of your kids, you know, may have responded instantly to the Lord and given their lives to Jesus, but there's that one that's just going to have to walk a lot harder, more uncomfortable road. They're going to come to the same truth. There's only hope in Jesus and no place else. Some people believe that quicker than others. It's interesting that when we offer God our prayers, we've already got a little 15-page outline in our mind, carefully researched. Oh, God, now I've researched my facts. And God's saying, oh, really? Well, should I write this down? God, this is the way it's done. The one who is holding the molecular structure of the solar system together as we speak. The one who thought it all up out of nothing and then created it and holds it together. That one is now going to hear our suggestions on the best way to do this. Their problem was not that they hoped. Please listen. The problem wasn't that they believed the promises of Scripture about God redeeming Israel, because God was redeeming Israel. The problem was they didn't believe all of the Scriptures about how that was going to happen. They had the evidence right there. I'm interrupting the story. Sorry. This is so much like me. Wrong emotional response at the wrong time. I just love how Jesus is. Can you see him smiling? I can't. I certainly don't see him scolding. And who knows whether they actually used the phrase turnip truck or not. I don't know. In the Bob movie version, they did. Some other euphemism.